No, I don't tell any stories. I feel like, well, there are two possible metaphors. One is the cadaver gets to speak at his own funeral, and the other is that the condemned man gets to shoot at his own execution. What? I don't know which is more appropriate. What I want to talk about, I certainly thank the organizers that maybe puts a somewhat negative cast on the thing, but I certainly want to thank the organizers for all their work, which I greatly appreciate, and everybody for coming, which I also greatly appreciate. And what I want to talk about is basically that we now have, thanks to the work of many people, but certainly Voivodsky's name is at the top, we now have a good theory of motives. Well, maybe that's too much to say, but we have at least a start of a good theory of motives. And the question arises what to do with it. So I think we have to develop apply the theory of motives. And one kind of application that I want to push today involves physics. And it turns out that physics gives rise to many interesting motivic situations that have been studied intensively by the physicists for years. Because very typically, these are situations where they absolutely need to know some period or some aspect of the situation for the most practical of reasons. So when that happens in science, there's a sort of an unfortunate process, because when you absolutely have to solve something, you do the best you can. And so there's a large area of physics where they did the best they could, and they're wonderful ideas, but there's much profit to be extracted from a more relaxed, careful mathematical, less time-intensive treatment. And in particular, the kind of thing that I'm going to talk about today. So if you're looking for problems, I suggest having a look at some of the physics literature. So I want to talk about, let me start out with a geometric situation. Let's suppose that we have a hypersurface. And I should say that this program is joint work with Hélène Hainaut and Dirk Kreimer. So my projective space, I take this particular odd dimension doesn't play a role for a while, but it will eventually. But it comes equipped with homogeneous coordinate functions. So 1 less equal to I less equal to 2 n. And I write the delta for the coordinate simplex. So delta is simply defined by the product of the AIs equals 0. And let me assume that the degree of x is equal to n, so roughly a half of the, and suppose that x is cut out by psi of a1, a2n equals 0, and I write omega for the usual homogeneous differential form. And let me write, I'll call it eta, for the so omega 2n minus 1 here, divided by psi squared. Okay, so the way I've chosen the numbers, my x is sort of a half of a Calabi-Yau variety, so to speak. Calabi-Yau would be if it had degree 2n, but so this is just right to make things so that this becomes a meromorphic differential form of top degree on the projective space. And it has a double order pole along x and nothing else. And so the physicists are interested in a certain period associated to this situation. And so I need a chain to integrate this form over. And so sigma will simply be the locus where all the AIs are non-negative. So it's a real chain. And the boundary of sigma is contained in delta. And so the object of interest, let me call it beta, is simply the integral over sigma of this eta. So that that's the interesting fellow. But there's a fly in the ointment. There are many flies in the ointment. But one of them is that this integral does not, in general, converge. So let me draw the picture. So here's a good picture. So this is my x, and here's my delta, and here's my chain sigma. All right. So it can happen that sigma stays completely away from the polar locus x, in which case my integral converges, and I have a nice, this beta is called a Feynman amplitude, and I have a nice Feynman amplitude. So here beta is defined. Okay. But, and nature being what she is, in the most interesting cases, it tends to happen that you get something like this. Namely, it will turn out, I mean, I'll tell you more about the situation as we go on, but it will turn out that the simplex, the simplex meets, of course, this is a projective situation, so of course the simplex is going to meet x just simply because of projective geometry, but what I care about is the chain, and the chain can stay away from x. But the more common situation, or the situation that arises in interesting cases, is that the simplex again is meeting x as it must, but the chain meets x, but only sort of a little bit. And in fact, one controls, and you'll see quite precisely, one controls the way the chain meets x very precisely. But in this case, it can happen that beta is not defined. So when that happens, the physicists go into an... Is anyone here a physicist? Likely to say some negative things about it. Oh dear. Don't tell your friends. Right. No, I'm joking. Of course, the whole inspiration is physics, and I'm not to be taken seriously. Anyway, beta is not defined. Then there is a sort of an elaborate literature on what's called renormalization. And it's a very deep and difficult subject. So I don't pretend that I have the answer for renormalization. But in its simplest avatar, it amounts to trying to make sense of this beta. And the answer that they get in this kind of a picture is that beta becomes not a number, but a finite sum of constants, let's say beta I, times log to the ith power of something that they call q squared over mu squared. Okay. And q squared is the external momentum, and mu squared is a scale thing here. But the truth of the matter is I don't understand this really much at all. But from the point of view of a mathematician, when you see something like this, and when you see that the answer is supposed to be a finite polynomial in log of something, of course, you immediately say why we should be looking at mixed Hodge structures. So let me remind you the game of limiting mixed Hodge structures. So I'll just state it abstractly. I won't try to match the particular situation. So abstractly, you imagine that you have a family of varieties over the punctured disk, so D star is the punctured disk with parameter, let's say, T. And you're looking at some family of cohomology, so HN, let's say, of the fibers, X, T. And in the classical case, everything is smooth and projective, but then the generalizations in recent years have dealt with more complicated situations where you have where the Hodge structure. So classically, the Hodge structure here is a pure Hodge structure, but in modern work, one has dealt also with mixed Hodge structures. But anyway, you have this family of things, and of course you have a monodromy. So you have a monodromy operator gamma, which maps. Let me call this HT. So gamma is an automorphism of HT. And a geometric argument show that this gamma is always quasi-unipotent. That means some power of gamma is always unipotent. And let me not worry about the quasi part, so let me assume that the gamma is unipotent so that I can write n, let's say, is the log of gamma, so then n is nilpotent. So n to some power, let's say n to the k, is 0. Okay. So then you know that the monodromy is given by exponential of n times log Sorry, just the exponential of n gives the monodromy. Let me say that better. I guess I want to, yeah. So to think about this family of Hodge structure, I can consider a map phi, let's say, from D star into, let me write boldface D for the moduli space of the appropriate moduli space of Hodge structures. So this is moduli of Hodge structures. But I have this ambiguity, and so this map would send T, so phi of T, would be the Hodge structure on this H sub T. But there's an ambiguity because of the monodromy, so I have to factor out by a certain discrete group gamma, just generated by the little gamma here. Okay, but then what the idea is you look, you kill the action, so you look at psi of t, which is defined to be the exponential minus n log times I guess I have to do it in two steps, don't I? I have to pass to the universal cover, so let me write U over D star to be the upper half plane. So this is, so here, T is the exponential of 2 pi I z. So U is the upper half plane. So then I can lift, so here I go to D mod gamma, here I go to D. So here I have phi, here I have twiddle. And if I take phi twiddle and multiply it by the inverse of the monodomy, note the minus sign here, phi twiddle, I end up not in D necessarily, because this is not an endomorphism of D, but I end up in the compact dual, which is a priori D is an open set in the pure case it's an open set in a compact dual. So this then makes sense as an element in the compact dual. The compact dual simply means for my Hodge structure, I forget about everything except the filtration. This is really a flag variety. It's just keeping track of the Hodge filtration. Okay, but then I've killed the monodromy, and so actually this factors then through, I should put a tilde here, and here I should put z, I guess, because I want to think of this as being on u. So this then should be thought of as a map from u to D check. But I've killed the monodromy, so in fact this factors back through D star. Like that. So let me call this psi with no twiddle. And the first fact is that psi extends to the origin. So you can talk about psi of zero, and that's an element in D check. And then you can try to, so to speak, squeeze the toothpaste back in the tube by multiplying by the inverse here, that is plus n log t, to try to recover your original variation. Well, of course, that doesn't work because you if you look at the exponential of plus n log t times psi of zero, then the theory tells you, the so-called nilpotent orbit theorem, tells you that if you, at least for t that's close enough to the origin, this is actually lies in D, which is contained in D check, and should be thought of as approximating the Hodge structure you're really interested in, which is phi of t. Okay, so that's a quick resume of the classical nilpotent orbit game. But notice what it gives you if I take a column here. Think of psi of zero as a matrix. If I take a column, so say beta naught, beta d, then I will be multiplying this column by what is essentially a matrix, which is whose entries are polynomials in log t. Okay, so here I have sort of a sum, n to the r log to the r of t divided by r factorial, but it's a finite sum. And so what I'm going to get then is a column where each entry is going to be a polynomial in log t. Okay, so now we want to apply that in this kind of situation. So let me say a few words about how that works. I have to tell you a little bit more in detail. So just vaguely, what we're interested in, maybe I should draw a companion picture here, we're interested in playing this game. Sort of, this is our x, and this is delta t, and this is delta, I'll now call it delta 0. So in other words, we're interested in moving our simplex in such a way that our chain stays away from our x. But I have to tell you, to make that plausible, I have to tell you a little bit more about the particular geometry that the physicists are interested in. So my x is then, I said it was defined by, I'm sorry, there are a lot of capital Phi's in this game. Sorry for that. Capital Psi equals zero, where capital Psi is a graph polynomial. So what's that? Well, if I have a graph, and always I've given this kind of talk before, and so I always draw the same picture, which is this one. So that's a graph which has six edges and three loops. Okay, so if I call this gamma, then gamma has edges E1 up to E6, and H1 of gamma, by which I simply mean the dimension of the first homology, is 3. Okay. Now, when I have a graph, there is associated to the graph a certain polynomial. So first of all, associated to the edges, I fix variables, which I call A1 up to A6. And psi is then the graph polynomial of gamma. Okay. Now I'm not going to give you a long spiel about graph polynomials. The degree. But there are some facts that are useful to know. The degree of psi is equal to this H1 of gamma. So in this case, it's 3. And psi has the following shape. It's a sum of monomials, AI1 times up to AIN, if I assume that my graph has N loops, where these things are distinct. So no variable appears in degree more than one. So the degree in any variable of psi is less than or equal to 1. And also, the coefficients are all just plus 1. Well, of course, it's 0. I mean, it can happen that a particular monomial doesn't appear. But if it appears, it appears with coefficient plus 1. So let's see. I should write those things down. Coefficients. I'll just write coefficients plus 1. With the understanding that they could also be 0. Okay. So what does that mean? Well, the first thing it means is that if I look at, remember, sigma was defined by all the coefficients being non-negative. So sigma intersect x simply means that each monomial is going to be a product of non-negative numbers. So therefore, the only way I can get a zero of this polynomial with non-negative entries is if I actually, if you think about it, it can happen, but it can only happen if I actually lie in a coordinate linear space inside of X. So what I'm saying is that this is actually contained in the union of L, where L, contained in my X, is a coordinate linear space. Coordinate linear space simply means that L is defined by the vanishing of some of these distinguished coordinates. Okay. So now we come to another important fact. Obviously, if we're worried about this divergence phenomenon here, we need to understand when it happens, and in particular, if it happened, and certainly many hypersurfaces have no coordinates, not arbitrary linear spaces, coordinate linear spaces. So there are only finitely many of these guys. Right? So we feel that we're kind of on top of things here. We've got pretty good control of this intersection. In particular, if you just took a hypersurface, chances are it wouldn't contain any of these things. But the basic little combinatorial fact is that if I have a coordinate linear space, so L, a coordinate linear space, then L is contained in my X if and only if, so suppose that L is defined by AI1 equals AIP equals 0, then L is contained in X if and only if the edges, EI, the corresponding edges, when I string them together to get a sort of a subgraph inside my graph, if and only if that supports a loop. So if and only if H1 of this subgraph is greater than 0. Okay? So, for example, here, if I number the edges, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, then with regard to that picture, I have that the locus A3 equals A5 equals A6 is contained in it. Right? Okay. Equals 0, yeah. So let's look at.
Did you write down the equation for X in this case?
It's. I'll tell you. I'll give you a sense of it. In this case, X is degree 3, and it has 16 terms. Okay. So, and that's a very, 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 very simple graph. Okay. But that one, if it happens, is not a problem. For this one, the integral, so here, beta is defined, and it's equal to some constant, which I think is 6, but I don't guarantee it, times the Riemann zeta function at 3. Okay, so it's an interesting number. And this all, I should mention, the work of Broadhurst, and Clymer years ago, where they did many, many calculations for much more complicated graphs than this.
And it,
this one doesn't diverge. Doesn't diverge. We'll talk about diverging in a minute. But let me give you an example of one that does diverge. Sorry. No, you can actually specify what it is. It's the positive. It's the L, once you're inside a linear hyperplane, then it will be the fellows with non-negative coordinates inside L. So it will meet. I didn't say it didn't meet, but you raise a good point because it can happen that the thing meets, but it doesn't diverge. So let's look at an example. You get a feeling for the issue here. So if we draw the graph, 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's a graph with four edges. The edges are correspond to the linear coordinates. So therefore, this is in P3. So the projective space is P3. And in this case, the I'll write it out for you. The integral, so the beta, looks like the integral over sigma 3 inside P3 of this omega 3, this homogeneous differential form. And then we divide by, so the graph polynomial in this case is A1 plus A2, A3 plus A4 plus A1. A2, and the whole thing has to be squared in order to get you the right homogeneity. Okay. Now, in this case, we can apply our little combinatorial lemma there, which I guess I can't really prove for you because I haven't told you what. Sorry? Just the dimension of. So I just write H1 of gamma for the dimension of H1 of gamma. Oh, in this case, it's 2. Yeah, so the degree of this is 2. I square, yeah, there are two things going on. The degree of psi is n, but I have to square it to get to 2. Yeah. So it's 2 in this case. But notice that it contains a little subgraph, namely the 1 and the 2, which support a loop. Right. So I let L be defined by A1 equals A2 equals 0. Then I know that my L is contained in my X by the above discussion. Okay. So I draw sort of stick figures. My artistry fails beyond dimension 2. In fact, L is a P1. But imagine that that's a P1. There. So we have that kind of picture. Okay. So notice the simplex. I mean, I have this big simplex here, and all these L's that appear in all these discussion, these coordinate linear spaces, are faces of the simplex. So the picture you should have in mind, the complicated picture, is I have a big simplex, and it meets the polar locus, this hypersurface. Well, it meets in a complicated way, but the real simplex inside it meets just along certain faces of the simplex. Okay, so let's look at this one. Let me write AI equals AI over A4, then you just unwind this a little bit, and what you get is something like this. And you blow up my L. So we blow up L, that means we introduce coordinates, and I'll just do it like this. So my coordinates will become A1, affine coordinates, A1, A2 over A1, and A3. Okay. So in those affine coordinates, my integral becomes something like this, A1 dA1 wedge dA2. Over A1 wedge D A3 divided by, there'll be an A1 squared times 1 plus A1 over, sorry, A2 over A1, and then A3 plus 1, and then plus A1 times A2 over A1, and the whole thing squared. So, you see, you cancel, if we cancel here and here, you see that this is then equal to, there will be a dA1 over A1 wedge some other stuff. And A1 is the local defining equation for the exceptional divisor of the blow-up. So I'm now in a situation where I've blown up, where shall I put it? I'll put it here. I've blown up this point, or it's actually the line, my picture becomes something like this. I have my this. I have my exceptional divisor, and my chain kind of looks like that. Okay, so this is the exceptional divisor E. But the on here I have my eta, and so if I call the blow-up map, I call the blow-up map, let's say pi, then I can have here pi upper star eta, and pi upper star eta has a log pole along E. Okay? Now, that's precisely the situation where you get divergence. So we get divergence. On the other hand, it's not too bad, because I could have had a quadratic or worse pole along E. And now we come to an interesting point from the physics. It seems that the interesting divergences are logarithmic. Now, I say it seems, I have to be very careful. This is work, ongoing work, and what I mean by this is that it seems to be possible when you, that the, what's controlling the physics are these Lagrangians and these theories. And that's something that really mathematics has nothing to say about. I mean, the physicists have to tell you what the Lagrangian is, which will tell you which graphs you're... You can certainly draw graphs that have worse divergences than this. But it seems that the interesting ones are logarithmic in the sense that when a quadratic or worse one appears, there is a natural way to write the integral as a linear combination of ones with logarithmic divergence. It's very important. It's very important. And this Hélène pointed out to us. I mean, we Dirk and I were all excited, and we came to her, and she said, it's very important that you have only logarithmic divergences. You'll see the point. Is that, was that your question?
No, but it's a general theory that, you know, if you have a gas mean connection, it always has at most regular singularities. Right? So from the point of view of the pi structure.
No, no, be careful, Arthur. Let me go on. I hope I'll address that question in a minute. Okay, because, you see, the general theory tells you that you can choose a differential form or a collection that I mean, this is the Deleen lattice or something. You can choose differential forms that will have only log poles. But it could be that the one, and you see, I don't get to choose this differential form. The physics tells me this differential form. I mean, there it is. And it could be the one that physics is selecting has a second order pole, in which case my fancy Hodge theory would simply give them the answer zero, which is not what they want. Because I would, well, anyway. Okay. So is that fairly clear then how you get these divergences. Now let me go off again and do some abstract business about how to set this this problem up with algebraic geometry. So let me start now. So D will be a disk, and P starts out as, so P has a number of different steps, but it ends up as your disk cross your projective space. So in other words, I'm going to do some transfer, some modifications, starting with just the constant family. So inside P, I have some other guys. I have a... So P used to be thought of as starting out with a disk cross projective space and blowing up. And I'm going to tell you a little bit what the blow-ups, at least vaguely what the relevant blow-ups are. So inside P, I want to give a number of divisors. I call them W, Y, and Z. And so P certainly wants to be smooth over C. And I want that W plus Y plus Z should be a normal crossings divisor. And I want, in addition, that Y should just be the fiber over 0, so just be P0. Okay, so if I call this map here pi, so this is just pi inverse of 0. Okay. So this is a very, very strong condition. It's certainly stronger than requiring that each of them individually be normal crossings. These are effective divisors. Nothing cancels here. I mean, it's really, everything is in good position with regard to everything else. Okay. So now, flat. No, I mean, Y is not flat.
Y, but W and Z.
W and Z, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is not terribly restrictive because I can shrink D. Okay. So now I want to talk about, here I should mention a paper of Luke Iuzzi. On limiting mixed hot structures and related things, which is a very nice paper. Unfortunately, I neglected to write down the reference. So let me just say, easy. And it's the paper that appeared in Asterisk, but I forget which volume. And he is describing his take on the theory of Steenbrink. And he writes down some complexes, which he calls omega. In particular, omega, so maybe I should do it in two steps. First of all, we can look at the Dirac complex for P over D, the relative Dirac complex. But this is not, P is not smooth over D because I assume that the special fiber can have normal crossings. So Steenbrink theory says you take log poles along D, I mean along the special fiber, but then I also want to take log poles along W and also log poles along Z. And then because I want to do I'm going to want to think of the geometry of the complement of W, but relative to Z. So here I take a minus Z. So this is about the most complicated Dirac complex you could imagine. Right? These are relative log poles with also some horizontal log poles, but also some horizontal vanishing. Okay, and you restrict this thing to the special fiber, and let me call this omega y. I'll put in the z here. Well, let me just call it omega y. Okay, and so it's a complex of sheaves on the special fiber. But you can also do something a little bit different, which is to look at the following. So you have your P over D. Now inside D you have the punctured disk D star, and then you can go to the universal cover here, which is the upper half plane, by just as I sketched earlier. And then you can pull back here, and this is typically called P tilde. Almost J tilde. And then here you have your Y included as the special fiber. And you can look at I inverse, brute force restriction, of J tilde lower star of omega dot of P tilde. And this contains, as a subcomplex, what Luke denotes by omega p, or maybe I, brute force restriction of omega p log t. So in other words, I include in this direct image here polynomials in log t. So log t lives up here. I think I called it z earlier, but let me call it log t. So I include sort of multivalued things which are given by polynomials in log t. And then I have something of the following sort. I have a picture of the following sort. I have I inverse omega p log t. And there's a rather curious map from this complex. So this is a complex supported on y. I forced it to be supported on y. To omega y, which simply, whenever you have a polynomial in log t, takes the constant term. Okay, so here I'll just write summation alpha I log t. The I just goes to alpha 0. And on the other hand, this complex can be related to the complex of vanishing cycles, now associated to, because I have done all this tricky business with W and Z, associated to a somewhat more complicated situation where I look at, let me just write it as Q lower star, lower shriek kind of fellow, which is to be, so I have P minus W minus Z, and this sits inside P, and I write this for the complex which says take direct image along W sort of minimal direct image, the lower shriek direct image along Z. And those two operations commute because everything is normal crossings. So I have a rather natural sheaf here on P. And the result of the Steenbrink theory is that, first of all, this is a quasi-isomorphism. And what's more, you have a quasi-isomorphism here with the psi, another psi. This is the psi associated to nearby cycles. So the psi here is I upper star R J twiddle lower star applied to the sheaf Q star shriek. And of course this I have to be careful because this is over Q, whereas this are, these are things are complex, so I have to complexify. Tensor C. Okay. So what is the point of this elaborate exercise? Now if we go back to the physics, we are given, did I erase it? I think I probably erased it. So recall, we have our eta on P2n minus 1 minus our x. I'll write x gamma, the graph hypersurface for this gamma. And we're going to do some blowing up and pull back to get a differential form. So let me describe, I don't have too much time, so let me describe at least in vague terms what I want to do. I start off with d cross p2n minus 1, and I want to blow up. So the thing, I have to do three things. One of them I want to do, and the other two I have to do. Okay, so since this is my birthday, I get to tell you about the thing I want to do, and not the things that I have to do. Okay, so what I want to do is to blow up the linear spaces where the faces where the simplex meets the graph hypersurface. So I will blow up low up, zero, so zero in the D coordinate, cross L's, I'll just say vaguely, where L's are contained in my graph hypersurface and are divergent. Well, no, let me just say L's are contained in the graph hypersurface. So, of course, that's a kind of a complicated process, and one has to be a little bit more clever than just that. But in this simple case, I would just be blow up this one L. That would be easy to describe. In general, it's quite complicated. But there's the algorithm, at least, is simple. You always blow up the smallest linear space first. And then you blow up the stick transform, and you find that way there's never any ambiguity, actually. It all just goes perfectly. So that has the effect of replacing the simplex by, it will never be this. That's interesting. It can be this, and then basically what happens is that I will get a collection of exceptional divisors, so EI, exceptional divisors, and then I can look at the intersection, so EI1 intersect EI. Okay, and these things basically will all look like products of projective spaces. That's not quite true, but in terms of discussing the simplices that one needs to define on these things, they look like products of projective spaces. See, in this simple case, I blow up a line. Since the normal bundle to a line is a direct sum of line bundles, the exceptional divisor, which is the projectivized normal bundle, is itself projective space cross L. Okay. And then the things that I don't want to tell you about are the truth of the matter is that my X here is a mess. X has very nasty singularities. And so I have to, in order to get myself in this nice normal crossings situation where the Steenbrink theory holds, I have to blow up on X. But fortunately, I never have to blow up. Let me tell you some nice thing that happens here. I have 5 minutes, so I'll describe a little bit the geometry. Oh, well, they can be. I mean, X is basically the determinant of a. It's a determinant, and so it has determinant-like singularities. No, I wouldn't even say no. No, it's basically they're beyond control, the singularities of X. But a very nice thing happened. So let me, in the remaining time, describe you the nice thing, and then tell you a little bit about what the limiting mixed Hodge structure is going to look like. The nice thing that happens is, suppose I have an L inside my X gamma, and suppose I blow it up. So then I can take the strict transform. So this is inside, so my P2N minus 1, I blow it up, I get a P. So here I take the strict transform. Let's take the total inverse image here. So the total inverse image will have two pieces. It will be a Y, and then there will be the exceptional divisor, E. And the nice fact is that when I look at Y intersect E, then this is a union. So E is a product. It's L cross P. If L has codimension P, that is P minus 1. And Y intersect E will be the graph hypersurface of a certain quotient graph, gamma slash gamma prime, union or cross P minus 1, union the other way around, L cross the graph hypersurface of a certain subgraph, gamma prime. So here gamma prime is a subgraph of gamma. Okay, so the effect of that is that I can control the intersection of chains on E with this intersection with Y intersect E. So remember, my problem began because I had an errant intersection. I had a chain that met the polar locus. When I blow up, I can still have chains that meet the polar locus, but because I can control things and because the objects in question are non-trivial sub and quotient graphs, I am in a simpler situation. So I'm out of time, but let me just sketch briefly the geometry of the... So remember, I wrote down for you phi of t. So what's going to happen here is something like this, and this is this I can't claim to have gotten this completely straight. My difficulty is, I forgot to say it, but the basic point is that eta, the differential form, gives a class, a section, not over all of y, but over a piece of y, of omega yn. Eta gives a section over the complement. There's some pieces of y that I didn't tell you about. The pieces of y I told you about are the exceptional divisors we're going to get by doing these blow-ups. But there are some pieces I didn't tell you about because there are these nasty singularities that we have to blow up. But those stay away from the topology that we care about, the chains that we care about. And my eta, which could have uncontrollable poles on the exception, on the components of why is this normal crossing divisor, my eta could have uncontrollable poles on some of the components, but on others, I can assume that it has just log poles.
You have two lines.
Two.
Fiber.
Yeah, this is a special fiber. That's a special fiber. So my special fiber looks like this. So that's Y. And my eta somehow lives down here and pulls back. Sorry? Yeah, so Y is the special fiber inside this P.
Yeah, but you also said Y is the
P transform. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, you're absolutely right. That's very bad. That's a disaster. Where did Y go? Y. Okay, so somebody give me another letter quickly. V. Okay. V. That's right. So here Y is, again, it's the special fiber. My eta gives me a section here which has log poles on the components I care about. So now this is very strange because, you see, I want to talk about limiting mixed Hodge structure. And ordinarily in this situation one talks about this maps to Hn on, not on all of y, but on y minus this y naught of this omega y. Now, if I had all of y here, this would be the limiting mixed Hodge structure. And I would have an element in the cohomology of the limiting mixed Hodge structure, which would correspond to a column. In the beginning of the hour, I talked about psi 0. That would correspond to a column of psi 0. And that would be my answer. Unfortunately, I have to throw stuff away. But the theory of Moriko Saito of Hodge modules tells me that even that I can restrict that this situation, I have a Hodge module on Y, and when I have a Hodge module, I can restrict it to an open set and still have a Hodge module. So therefore, I get a Hodge structure even on this open set. So I'll stop there. I hope to say a little bit more about the precise nature of the powers of log that appear, because you can analyze them. But I think there's a lot of the physicists quite candidly could do with some help here, and I encourage people who like to think about applied motives to have a look at the literature. Okay. Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, originally, when you start from the Feynman diagram,
mm-hmm.
you end up with a polynomial.
Mm-hmm.
And the question arises, what is the physical interpretation of the
line? Yes. Absolutely, absolutely the right question. That question, I think the physicists have some response to, which would be what? If you look at the work of, this is joint work, I said, with Dirk Kreimer, and he is known in physics for his Hopf algebra. His take on renormalization involves a certain Hopf algebra of graphs. And you see, where it meets the intersection is a union of a graph hypersurface for a quotient graph and a subgraph. Well, that's exactly Dirk's Hopf algebra appearing. So Dirk's Hopf algebra is controlling not only the exceptional divisors, but how the strict transform of my polar locus meets those exceptional divisors. So a careful analysis of the situation passes through his Hopf algebra, and his Hopf algebra is basically the combinatorics of this that I just said quickly. But let me, since you raised that question, let me change it slightly and ask you as the representative of physics in the room, because the question that I would have to the physicists is that, you see here, what I did is I moved my simplex. Physics gave me a simplex that sat like that. And I said I didn't like that one. I wanted to integrate over this one over here. Right? So I changed my simplex, which meant, in terms of quadrics, I changed the linear combinations of the quadrics. And the real question that a mathematician would ask the physicist is, does that family of syntheses, does that have a physical meaning? Does it mean something physically to move the quadrics away from their standard position? So the quadrics are the propagators in the Feynman thing, and they are rank 4 quadrics. But I'm taking linear combinations. I'm changing the physics with the ambition ultimately of passing back to the one you care about, but I'm introducing these others. And so the physicist would write q squared over mu squared. I write t squared. And I do not understand the relation between those two. I'm happy because it's a log. They get a polynomial log. I get a polynomial log. That's nice. But their coordinates are the external momenta divided by a scale factor. And mine is this parameter space of syntheses, and that's the relation between those are totally obscure. Okay, enough of my...